Hi, everyone. It's Dr. Denise. I'm here today with Kirk Miller. I'm so excited to have him on the show. He and I met probably almost 2.5 to 3 years ago on Twitter. And Kirk, I respect him so much because he has really given a voice to so many people and in such a way where he advocates people to make sure they go out there and get their own best opinion, advocate for themselves. And he wrote this amazing book too that we're going to talk about. But Kirk, can you tell us a little bit about your journey and like who you are?
Oh, definitely. I grew up in a small mountain town, and around the age of, well, in my 20s, I always struggled with school and was kind of labeled as a troublemaker. It was long before they were really familiar or aware of some of the issues like what I was diagnosed with. So in my 20s, I was really struggling, did really well in college for, you know, one semester, then I'd drop out for the next, then I'd go back, then I'd drop out. And I was struggling so much just trying to hold down a job, just continue to function, that we eventually went out and started seeking some help from a psychiatrist. I'd seen psychologists my whole life since I was about 12.
Can you take us back to some of your maybe descriptions of your childhood behavior in some ways that manifested so that we can kind of qualitatively talk about it? Because I think a lot of people have troubles talking about things, and things tend to come in labels instead of qualitative styles of the way people's behavior might be.
Oh, absolutely. When I was, first of all, with food, I was beyond picky. It had to be a specific texture. It wasn't even as much the taste, but the consistency and texture would bother me. So there weren't many foods that I could have. I was definitely what people would consider to be hypersensitive. If my sister was eating a food and I didn't like the way it sounded, I couldn't be around it. And again, that had nothing to do with her. I just couldn't stand it. Or if I turned on the faucet, and that, you know, that even went to my clothing. Most clothing really bothered me. A lot of times I would wear my shirts inside out so that the soft part of the seam was against the skin. And so that was kind of the beginning part, but the behavioral issues.
Wait, can we pause? This is actually very crucial what you just said. So sensory issues, we all process and perceive our environment our own unique way. You've heard me talk about neurostyle. And so I include kind of all ways of processing, whether it's sensory, sound, touch, feelings, emotions, and thoughts. And what Kirk just described is having issues with hearing the crackling of food or different shirt textures. And people can have this with different sensory overload with the sun. And I don't mean people who are having migraines. And so Kirk, it's really interesting because my son, people might know, if they follow me on Twitter, whenever I usually share videos, he's usually wearing the same yellow shirt. And he does have other shirts that he wears, but he too has a very big aversion to different materials. And so also with textures, there's a certain group of foods that he likes. And so what's interesting is in the time that I've been raising him and also with my background, I knew about sensory issues because I'm an MD and I'm a child psychiatrist. But my son also had occupational therapy where he has been exposed then to that's little slime stuff. He's been exposed to things that would kind of challenge his sensory so he could be less rigid and more flexible. And I think probably when you were growing up, that wasn't something people were aware of.
No, definitely. At the very first time, really, my mom never quite understood why. But trying to get me dressed in the morning took forever. And typically I just would wear the same kind of clothing consistently. If I would have had my choice, there, like you'd mentioned with your son, there were a few shirts that just were really comfortable. They breathed well, and I would always go back to those if I would have had my choice. Now, granted, my mom didn't want everyone at the school, including my friends, you know, thinking that I only had one pair or one, you know, one pair of pants and one T-shirt. So she did her very best to try to find, you know, clothing. She was also very patient with that process because, you know, my sister was just delightful and very easygoing. And I think in a lot of responses a lot of reasons she was doing that because she was kind of offsetting me. So she was helping my parents out.
So this is actually really crucial because your mom sort of paved the way. She knew intuitively. And I think that's a very important thing that you and I are going to keep going back to, that your mom kind of knew what was best for you. You started to know what was best for you. And I think as we're raising our children, no matter what sensory style is, it's okay too, if you want to wear a shirt that's mostly the same shirt. In fact, I've given my son sort of a dialogue. He knows that he says, oh, my sensory stuff. We've come up with like really empowering words that he likes. So it's also important that we find words that make us feel good. And you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you know this, Kirk, but did you know Target? I know that other places, this is just has, it's this, it's called adaptive clothing for children now. They have, it's called Cat and Jack.
No.
So my son's dad found these shirts too that are very soft for him. So I think what we're talking about is having a sensory processing. And by the way, everyone knows the word disorder for me is like nails on the chalkboard.
Yeah.
Because I think we're going to kind of segue into that because, you know, I'm an MD. So of course I honor science. I honor my Western medicine training, but how I understand the universe and from my Eastern influence is that words, thoughts, and feelings carry their own vibration. And so one of the reasons why I came up with the word neurostyle, that we all process and perceive information in our own unique way, that gives people a new, more empowering way to talk about when they're having challenges. And so I've been raising my son, and I feel like I know your mom, Kirk, because in the time that I've gotten to know you through direct messages on Twitter and some phone calls we've had, I feel like your mom and I have lived, I know you're you and my son's him. I feel like your mom and I have almost lived some like parallel universes with raising our children.
Well, I know that, she is one of the most delightful people. I was really very lucky to have a supportive infrastructure around me with a nuclear family. And I know that doesn't always happen. And sometimes people have to look outside. And that goes to like, sometimes they have a really close friend. And that friend becomes kind of their trusted source to listen. I was very lucky that it happened to be my family, and a lot of the things like you just mentioned, I wanted to go jump right back to that with, I don't even necessarily like the word hypersensitivity because for me, it's the word that comes after hypersensitivity that bothers me. Being hypersensitive is fine, but like you'd mentioned, calling it a hypersensitivity disorder or a hypersensitivity, I'm not sure what the proper medical term is.
Right, right. So it's sensory processing disorder. But what I want to say is one of the things, and I know this is why you and I are so excited, and I want to get back to like all the qualitative descriptions of what you went through, but where you and I are talking about the words, when we're talking and communicating to people, there's a universal kind of knowledge or definitions that we know. And so what I'm passionate about doing is bridging my Western medicine knowledge. Like I'm a physician. I've seen 40,000 hours of patients. I know how to make appropriate diagnoses to help people, but I also know how to help empower people to not land on those words, because I explain to my patients that, you know, good for you, that you had the courage to come seek out help, to feel well. but that a lot of the words that are in the Western medicine science background are very, they're meant to validate that there are symptoms that someone's suffering with. So that part of the disorder part, I champion. But the word disorder, when it comes to people's mental health, by default, it creates a stigma factor. And I think I would love to hear your thoughts on all this from everything, your journey and labels that you've had, but also sometimes getting those diagnoses is also the most empowering thing to say, I have OCD or I have ADHD. So there's the linear language is so precise, it doesn't carry that ability to have that shades of gray and context around it. So we can kind of keep pushing forward with new ways of talking about
things. Oh, that was beautifully put. And, you know, actually it was about maybe, I'm thinking a little over 2 years ago when I started referring to everything as a mental health issue, because issue is very wide open. And if we have an issue, it can have positives, it can have negatives, it can have a whole host or let's just call it a spectrum of things that we can refer to it. If we use the word illness, again, like you said, in Western medicine, it's meant to be there for people to understand that there's, as you'd mentioned, this perfect word, there's suffering that's happening. But as the individual, when I was told, listen, you have a mental illness, that was something, actually, I remember the day that word was used, and my exact reaction was, no, I don't. I stood up. He had kind of one pretty soft couch for usually like myself, and then my mom would come with me. And then like a chair, if somebody would prefer a chair. So there wasn't like the, you know, I guess the cliche single couch, you know, in that type of room. It was more just a standard room, wonderful man. But he sat with me, and at the end, after asking me some very interesting questions, some that really caught me off guard. And I will be forthcoming too, you know, if you're out there and you feel like you are struggling, you know, it's fine to research. The only problem with if you go too far into your research and you start self-diagnosing, that can cause some problems. Because I knew enough that when I went in there, he kind of picked up on that. And so the questions he asked went right around the lower amount of knowledge that I had. So, you know, I knew just enough to be harmful to myself. So the questions he asked me were really good. And I remember at the end of the session, he sat there and he said, okay, this is what you have. He said, you have, you know, a pretty complicated one. He said, I would diagnose you with these four things. He said, two of these are very close together. So he said, you have generalized anxiety. He said, and I had already been diagnosed with ADHD early on. So I think I was maybe 13 or 14. And my dad had never wanted me to necessarily be on some of the stimulants when I was young. He was a pharmacist. And so he just kind of looked at the medication and he wanted me to see as far as I could go. And it's probably a good thing looking back on it, especially because bipolar was there, that the stimulants might have had a negative effect on me in terms of setting off my mania at a much earlier age and to maybe a more severe degree, which is one reason why I think it's so important to utilize, as you said, you know, we have the Western medication approach, and some people really need that. There's other people that do really well. For me, I have to do my medication, but if I don't add in things like working out, meditation, ways to relax, especially when I'm feeling like a panic attack coming, if I don't utilize a multi-pronged approach, I'm not as stable, and I don't continue to improve at the same rate. So I don't think there's one magic way to fix anything. It's a combination of a whole bunch of approaches, and different things are going to work for different people. And I think that's one reason why I love your word neurostyle, because every individual is going to have a unique style even going into their treatment and how they improve.
Well, and you know, I think one of the things that you and I are both champions of is that whether someone sees a psychiatrist or a psychologist or reaches that point where they need to seek out a higher level of mental health help, that we all have our own neurostyle. We all process and perceive information in our own unique way. And so the reason why I like neurostyle too is because I am, as a physician who has worked with people through the shame they feel and, you know, oh my goodness, I just got diagnosed. And, you know, I've taken people through this process where I said, no. And I say, please, now we're going to help. And I look at everything as like a tool in its toolbox. So what you just spoke of for all of us, whether we seek out medical care or not, I feel like there's an essential core ingredients to happiness, which I would say include awareness, self-love, and altruism.
Oh, I like those.
So I think, yeah, so when I've, what, and you know what? Those are universal truths. If you look at Eastern medicine, Western medicine, Darwin, if you look at different religions in the world, we're all very much saying similar things. So if we have the word like neurostyle, that's all encompassing. And when I was in India, well, I want to speak to your multi-prong approach. So in Western medicine, when I was in training, and now there's the biological, psychological, social. And then I've added, when I spoke in India, and this, you can put this under social, but I specifically add spiritual and cultural awareness.
Oh.
And so then when you, what'd you
no,
say?
Go I'm ahead. Sorry. I'm enjoying.
Yeah. And so what everyone needs to remember is that we have our own unique way of interacting with our environment. And so some people are the most gifted artists. They channel things, artwork, entrepreneurs. And so I have the coolest, most privileged, honored ability as an MD to connect with people over long periods of time. So my patients, it's like an old school, old fashioned practice where, you know, I have someone that was bullied in middle school that was diagnosed with a bit of like it was called Asperger's at the time, because I think people, you know, even autism, there's all these words that people get afraid to say, but he had sensory perception challenges, highly intelligent, ADHD, was bullied, 12 years old. Fast forward to now, he's 25. He has a PhD. He's in a healthy relationship. He found the right school. And so it wasn't just seeing myself and going, okay, here's the diagnoses. But then I walked him through non-stigmatizing ways of viewing his strengths, that some of the ways he interacts and his levels of awareness, like Kirk, I want to hear more about your journey, but this is for everyone to think about, how boring would the world be if we were all like little robots that were the same, right? And so people walk out of my office, like they get the solution to maybe what they were suffering, but then there's a more holistic approach. I talk about anti-inflammation nutrition plan, exercise, if someone, whatever their own belief system is with regard to religion or spirituality, with meditation and prayer. And meditation standalone, you and I can talk about that too, is incredibly powerful, because meditation and mindfulness is a tool that allows greater awareness. And when you have greater awareness, you're more aware of your physical and emotional sensations. So you would know to go seek out help if your stomach's aching or you're having a headache or you're sad or angry. And so I want to, with you, because I know this is what you've done in your advocacy for others, these are just starting points of conversations that we all process and perceive information in our own unique way. And like one of my dear friends, we just did a show on this. Once she introduced the word neurostyle into her home, one of her family members, instead of saying my anger issues, he's like, well, my neuro style is that I get upset more easily.
Well, and that's such a great thing. And, you know, I went into the story and I never finished. When I was diagnosed, I left the room. I got up, said, no, I'm not. And I walked out. And granted, all he said was, you have bipolar 1 disorder, you have obsessive compulsive disorder, you have generalized anxiety, and, you know, as we had already known, ADHD. I heard those. No, I don't. Stood up, left the room, slammed the door behind me, and of course, my poor mom was left in the background. So, you know, for me, the words, 3 of them had disorder in them, or 2 of them had disorder in them. And the generalized anxiety, my very first question was, does that go away? Is that something, you know, it's like, no, it's something that we can help. We can, you know, we can lessen, but that's something that's going to stay around. He said it's different than social anxiety. And, you know, all of those things were kind of tied together. And what he was trying to explain, and when I went back the next week, and granted, I think it was like pulling teeth to get me to go back again. He'd written me a whole bunch of prescriptions and I had to go get a whole bunch of blood tests done. You know, it's a scary situation when you're in your early 20s and then you're told that you have all of these problems. Number one, that won't ever go away. Number two, that cause concern enough that they're worried about, you know, you causing harm to yourself and other people, that you have to be on really heavy medications. And then the medications I was put on, you know, the side effect for a lot of them long-term was, you know, organ damage. Some of them were really scary. The first one that he put me on was an anti-seizure medication that they do a lot of times for mood stabilization. It was one of the cleaner medications that I took, which was Lamictal, or Lamotrigine is the generic term. And even with that one, he said, you know, we're going to start off slow because you can get this, you know, severe rash. And so it was a very scary situation. And when you're told, of course, the only way that they can tell you is they have to use the proper words and they have to read out the diagnosis. But the pain some of those words cause and how...
Well, wait, I don't disagree with you. I think you're right. When you go see a professional, there's words because there's diagnoses, but I think the quality, the essence, the therapeutic relationship, a non-stigmatizing approach to talking about mental health, saying you're Kirk. So what I do is I'm like, okay, I have this sheet of paper here. It's the insurance codes. However, you're Kirk. Here are some qualitative styles that you have of relating to the world. And then we have to come up with a way that science knows how to treat it, but you don't have to land on those because you, even if you're suffering now, even if that diagnosis is super powerful and it explains, it's like an aha moment for someone bipolar, OCD, you can have a thrive quality of optimal mental health and you can thrive with any diagnosis. And we can talk about that. So I think you're right. The doctor did need to give you those labels and there's nothing wrong. He probably was just fine. It's also where your own mental health state is. Like I always ask my patients right when they come in the room, was it your idea or someone else's to come here?
Well, I know that I think the person that he really was making it clear for was my mom, because she was with me during that moment. And I think that he wanted to make sure she understood the gravity and the seriousness of what she was facing and what she was looking at, and that her son was really going to struggle. So I think some of the dialogue that I heard was there and he wanted to make sure that everyone knew it was really serious. I don't think that any of it was ever meant to cause me personal duress or discomfort. It did. But one thing that I would say is being frustrated and angry about having something where they said, you're never going to find a treatment. And I looked, that's everything I read. I started reading medical journals. I started reading textbooks. And that drive, honestly, being told I can't get better or I can't necessarily get rid of it, it was probably the driving factor behind my research and what eventually led me to a life of stability. I was determined to defeat, ever since I grew up, I was always the type of person, if somebody said, you cannot do this, I wanted to show them how good I could do it. Not just that I could, but I could be the best. That was kind of my personality.
That's fantastic.
Fantastic. So in some ways, you know, the labels, when I see them, you know, the labels themselves don't upset me as much as I think the misconceptions around them.
You know what? That's, you know, it's really interesting because even I'm like listening carefully to you and I have this discussion. If you're practicing neutrality and you've mentioned how powerful, you know, words are, this is the lesson for all of us, which is what I wish our children would learn at a very young age. The word OCD, bipolar, ADHD, those have come with a lot of stigma because there's been a lot of the ways things have been portrayed in movies and the ways people talk about it gets very polarized. And so if we were taught that words themselves are powerful, but take a neutral approach to whatever you're faced with and have a non-judgmental, you know, I think we've got a long way to go in integrating these universal ways of accepting that there's different levels of awareness. And so I was wondering, Kirk, with that being said, can you give some qualitative descriptions of behaviors that represented your OCD or ADHD or bipolar and maybe the challenges of having those symptoms, but then also maybe like almost like the blessings as well? Because that's the other part that I view, that there's all of the parts of our personality and dimension can come with challenges, but they also can be gifts.
Definitely. I think I'll start with the generalized anxiety, which is, it's kind of a constant fear of really small things, big things, paying my credit card on time, paying, you know, the electricity on time. And it goes as far as when I really knew I had it was I was playing with a friend's baby, tossing it up in the air, you know, very gently, of course. I wasn't like throwing the baby across the room, but, you know, I was just tossing the baby up and down. And after that, they went home. And for the next three nights, I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking like, what if this would have happened? What if I would have dropped it? What if, and you know, all I was doing was playing with the baby. And of course I couldn't stop worrying about it. The same thing kind of happened with different tests. Now, granted, not as much with like test anxiety, stuff like that, but more with like, I'd wake up and the weather would be different, and I'd be freaked out about the sump pump in the basement. You know, little things that necessarily all they needed to do was be checked. Okay, they're okay. Move past it. Now, granted, the positive side of that is that I do pay my bills on time. I have good credit. I typically take really good care of things before they get out of control. So there's the negative and there's the positive of that one. For ADHD, I think the negative aspects were when I was in school and it was so hard for me to focus. And so a lot of teachers immediately labeled me as less intelligent. Some of my classmates did too. I had a couple wonderful teachers that kind of saw past that. I was actually doing algebra in fourth grade, and I had her name was Miss Divine. She was wonderful, and she recognized that, okay, this child just is not working in this classroom. And so she set me in a side room, and it was just myself and one other, and I would just do the math the whole time. And I loved it. And that was the only grade that I got to do that in. And then after that, I was kind of thrown back in, totally lost interest in math, didn't do algebra again until I think my, you know, sophomore or freshman year or something in high school. So, you know, there were the negative aspects where friends couldn't talk to me, or if I was watching, say, a TV show, or if I was typing a paper and somebody asked me a question, I would lose track of both. I couldn't hear the question, and I would forget what I was doing on the computer. Now, granted, the positive aspect of ADHD is almost a hyperfocus. If I put on earphones and put on music, for me, the trick is I can't listen to music with words. If there's words in it, it'll pull me out. It's the same thing as somebody trying to talk to me. So I typically find soundtracks or classical music, jazz, anything without words. And that kind of gives me some white noise. And then if I'm working on the computer, I can stay focused for hours. Or if you want to talk about a video game, if you stuck me in front of a video game, my focus is locked in. So
yeah, so
that's a gift there.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's a myth buster. Because a lot of parents come to me like, oh, my child doesn't have ADHD because they can sit in front of the da-da-da for hours, or they can do. And so the hyper focus, it's like you have to have enough interest. There's a threshold for excitement. I call it, whether you want to say healthy adrenaline rush, I talk with people like in that those terms, or you're really excited about the material. So what's so cool about that, once you get your own optimal mental health plan that includes your nutrition, your fitness, your sleep, your exercise, your friendship group, giving back to the world, whether you have ADHD or another possible diagnosis, or you don't have a diagnosis, you can use some of these qualitative levels of awareness to your advantage, as long as you're aware. So like if it's you, Kirk, and you're going and you're about to do something you love, like I know I want to hear about your writing and your books, you probably use that behavior trait to your advantage as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And even with when I'm working with students, so my day job is teaching violin, and I do all one-on-one. And part of the reason for that is that when I'm working one-on-one with a student, my focus is 100% on them. There's nothing else there. So I can kind of catch every little tiny thing that needs to be adjusted or fixed, or even, you know, when they come in and they kind of set their violin down too hard or something like that, I can usually pick up how they're feeling. So ADHD gave me some very unique gifts in terms of just being able to kind of focus in and see. And granted, there's some hypersensitivity that kind of came with some of that stuff. The other one that I really, you know, I know a lot of people struggle with is bipolar.
Before we go there, you just said something very important, that you can tune into other people's feelings. And so there's a term that Dr. Judith Orloff gave us, and she's a pioneer in psychiatry and bridging spirituality and empathy and intuition. And she, if everyone wants to go to judithorloff.com, O-R-L-O-F-F, and you might have to put the MD in off to see, but she talks about being an empath. And that's when we can feel and experience other people's feelings on a different level. So to me, that's a level of awareness,
yeah.
Right? And so that is actually a gift. And I'm not saying everyone with ADHD is an empath, because they're not. But do you see how qualitatively rich and exciting we all are? I mean, you have this, and I know you are so nurturing. Like I can feel it every time I hear you when we've had conversations about your students. I think, oh my goodness, they are like the luckiest students because Kirk can feel their feelings. I'm thinking he's probably this gifted musician. And so this is what I celebrate. When I work with people, I celebrate the whole person. So it, whether someone has ADHD or bipolar, it doesn't mean they're not going to be an absolute rock star at what they want to do. It doesn't mean that they're not going to also dodge, you know, some suffering that can come along with it. So your empathy is like one of the most amazing signatures of who you are and who your soul is.
You know, I really appreciate that statement. And, you know, the other part is, I think part of the reason why I am empathetic and I want to be compassionate and strive to be a better person every day is because of a lot of the misconceptions and the, you know, how I was treated. The doctors that took care of me were all wonderful people. They're trying to do their job. But when they saw, you know, something like bipolar on my chart, there's an instantaneous kind of pullback. And, you know, when my main doctor retired and he was the one I was doing some case studies with, wonderful man, I went through about 6 or 7 doctors and, you know, really struggled to find somebody, first of all, that was willing to work with me. A lot of them would send me on. They just didn't want to even deal with it. And these were doctors that had on...
You mean psychiatrists?
Both some psychiatrists and some MDs.
And was it because you were so smart and you were sort of challenging and asking them to look and at things in a unique way?
A lot of it was because I was asking them to say, listen, this is working. You know, I've been stable for 3 years. The reason I wrote my book is specifically, I actually was not, I'd never written a nonfiction book before because I prefer writing, you know, thrillers or mysteries, you know, fantasy books.
You know, can I, this might be good because I know how it is. I just want to tell everyone, Kirk's talking about his book, his memoir, Chaos to Cured, The True Story of Defeating Bipolar Disorder. And I want to read this quote because we're talking about doctors. This is a quote from Dr. Robert Simon on the back of Kirk's book. After practicing medicine for over 40 years, I never dreamed that one of my patients would discover the most effective method of treating bipolar. I hope everyone will find Mr. Miller's memoir as inspiring and surprising as I found watching his recovery.
Oh, I love that quote. That man was one of the most amazing doctors. And he was the one that kind of watched me go through the darkest times in my life and then also saw me kind of pull out of it. And the foreword to my book is actually one of the individuals who asked me to write it. His Dean P. Stull, S-T-U-L-L, wonderful man. He was the inventor of Taxol, which is a one of the most widely used chemotherapy drugs. It took me quite a few years to get him some data and to show him kind of what we were working on and what I was doing. And after kind of dealing with me for a few years, he said, you know, you got to get this out there. Just get it out there. He said, it's going to take years for people to start researching this and getting into this. And he said, there's a lot more that, you know, we're going to have to do, you know, to get clinical trials going. And that's something that is still one of my long-term goals. I was very, very lucky to be asked to write it. So when I wrote the book, there were a couple of purposes that I wanted to do. One was to,
yeah. Wait, can I ask you a real quick question? So for me as an MD, because I'm a practicing adult and child psychiatrist, as I'm doing the influencing in the world, what's most important is that I think people need to be open and aware that there are many pathways to healing. As an MD in Western medicine who also honors all belief systems, I've seen a combination. I call it tools in the toolbox. There might be Western medicines that work for you. There might be a combination of acupuncture, prayer, meditation. And then we know what one of the big foundational problems with dis-ease, by the way. When I was in India at His Holiness Body Mind Life Conference in fall of 2018, presenting on nurturing children's mental health, one of the unifying things, because there was people from India, from Muslim traditions, it was the Super Bowl of mental health. It was so cool. So much of everything's about anti-inflammation, and there's a lot of foods that could be very therapeutic. And so I'm wondering, can I ask you a question? Because you have this data, because I've never had someone with bipolar in my practice on Taxol. In fact, it's not mainstream. So as a doctor, we have to be careful because there's liability. So I think that getting the clinical studies is out. But you know, Taxol is a mitotic inhibitor. It targets and rapidly grows. It's a cancer medicine. So what it does is it...
The one I'm on is actually an anti-estrogen. So...
Anti-estrogen. So which one are you on?
Tamoxifen citrate.
Tamoxifen. So let's talk about that. How did you find that? Or do you want people to get the book and really... Can you tell us how that happened?
Even if I kind of explain some of this stuff, it won't take away from the book. Because really the reason... What I try to do is write the book more like I would a story so people can really... feel and see what somebody going through a manic phase is like, or what depression really actually feels like. The way I found this treatment was I started doing a lot of reading from medical journals, and I started finding kind of a disconnect between psychiatry and endocrinology, hematology, all the different specializations. And there were a couple things out there that really kind of caught me off guard. And granted, one of them was I was suffering from an autoimmune disease. And it causes inflammation. The typical treatment for that, it's linear IgA, is dapsone. Or a lot of times they'll use prednisone, which is a corticosteroid. And I started doing a lot of research on the corticosteroids. That led me to go, okay, why isn't anyone in the United States using anabolic steroids? And because some of those have positive side effects, such as hardening the bones, you know, strengthening the bones, strengthening the immune system. And at the same time, they had the anti-inflammatory effects that some of the prednisone did. So what I did was what I would tell no one to ever to try to do, always work with your doctor and don't ever try to do things. But I started experimenting with anabolics. It took care of my, it took care of my IgA and my...
Can you explain to everyone the IgA? Because I want to make sure that people understand that you were faced with, which is very much... why I love the whole Eastern approach, because it's a holistic system. So people can have overlap. In fact, that's why I'm so excited Western medicine's getting there. So you had an autoimmune diagnosis plus mental health diagnosis. Can you explain to everyone specifically what the autoimmune issue is?
Yes, definitely. So what would happen is my skin would just randomly blister, and they'd be clusters. So they looked like sunburn blisters. And when they would pop, they would crystallize with this yellowish color, which a lot of doctors thought was impetigo. I think maybe 10, maybe 12 different dermatologists, and each one took a biopsy, sent it to the lab. Nobody could figure it out. The disease was not discovered until 1996, and it was officially, you know, caught then.
Your disease or your specific
that particular disease, linear IgA, was not known and was not really officially written up until much later. And I was one of only a few cases in the United States. And that particular one, the reason he caught it was he sent it to one lab, a health lab, and then he sent it also to a university. And the university, these students were kind of given a challenge to try to figure this out. So when I got that medication that they were treating me with was Dapsone. And that one is a very scary medication long term. This is another thing that does not go away. The IgA does not go away. So I was forced with yet another medication. And all of these medications being put into my body really scared me. So I started looking for some alternatives and I started doing some self-experimentation. And I walked into my doctor's appointment. And to give everyone an idea, because of all the things I have dealt with, I really couldn't function going to a doctor's appointment by myself. I couldn't fill out the paperwork. I knew how to write. It had nothing to do with that. But between anxiety, the OCD, just walking into a doctor's office, trying to sit down on a chair that was uneven, it was very difficult. So I went into my doctor's appointment, and it was the first time I walked in, I filled out all the paperwork. They called me back and Dr. Simon walked in and he's like, okay, what's going on? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, your mom's not here. You're here alone. You seem calmer. He said, you've gained weight. And he said, you look healthy. He said, it's not unhealthy weight. He's like, what's going on? And that was when I told him everything I was doing. And then I had, on top of everything else, I have a hematologic, or I have a problem with my blood. I'm not.
So Kerr, this is actually really crucial. I think if people had just heard only a snapshot of some of the behavioral challenges you had, or for themselves, this is why it's so important. When you're having mental health issues, it's great that we can find support groups and things online and social media. But Kirk, like even now I'm thinking, wow, this is like a second show. because what Kirk's describing is that he's had other medical things that are all probably, this is what's so cool is I think, I'm so sorry, by the way, when I say so cool that you're sharing this with us, because there's an overlap with inflammation. I'm hearing ding, 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 ding. You, there's the core, there's the mental health challenges, there's the medical challenges. But if you read his book, which is fantastic, it's his own fight for his own health and well-being. So I want everyone to feel incredibly empowered by Kirk because he has been his own soldier for his own health and wellness. And that's what his passion is for telling people. Would you agree that that's one of your big missions?
Yeah, actually, I think what I realized was that when I decided to look at having these things as what, instead of being the things that defined my negative aspects, being the things that defined my positive aspects, it made the stress level lower. And it made having bipolar and having OCD not so bad. There's definitely there are some horrific experiences that I went through, and depression is not something I would ever wish on any person, nor would I wish mania. But had I not had bipolar, I've written 9 manuscripts. One of which I actually did get an offer from when I was bipolar and I was a little paranoid and I thought they were going to steal my idea. So I turned it down. But I wouldn't have done that. I paint, I draw. I am quite good at the violin. As far as that goes, I have had the opportunity to play with, as a soloist with a few orchestras and, a lot of, even as a young child, I was honored to get to play with some phenomenal violinists. One of my friends was the late Eugene Fodor, who was the first American to win the Tchaikovsky violin concerto competition. I think if you look it up under Wikipedia, he's listed as a silver medalist, and there's no gold that year. They gave both the first and second place winners silver. Why they didn't give them both a gold, I don't know. But, you know, so all of those things and being on this show, doing the things that I am, being able to help the people that I do, I wouldn't have been able to do those things without having gone through some rough times. And I don't think I would understand other people if I hadn't suffered in a lot of different ways, from both a medical and health standpoint. I was always sick as a child. Now I don't deal with the sickness as much, but there's other issues. Even living at this high altitude, you know, I'm on oxygen at night to keep my erythropoietin levels down. Usually that's a good thing to have high erythropoietin levels. But
So because you're qualitatively describing your wellness plan, can you go through what your Western medicine diagnoses are and then go through your specific multi-prong approach so that people have sort of an idea, and then I'll make a commentary because I really want people to walk away because they're going to try to figure out what do I do or how do I start my journey of health and
well-being. Definitely. I think so with ADHD, they prescribe typically stimulants. For my OCD and generalized anxiety, both of those they treat with one medication, which is a benzodiazepine. Which is a central nervous system depressant. So the exact opposite of the ADHD one. Then for the bipolar, they typically have a mood stabilizer, a lot of times an anti-seizure, an antipsychotic. A lot of times there's a mixture of medications. And then for, I'm trying to remember what the last one was here. I think I covered all four. Those, so what I do is I wake up every morning, I take my medications. I definitely suggest to anybody starting their journey, take a look at the whole body. That was one thing that took me a long time to get a feel of. And my thyroid was off. So I do take a thyroid medication, mostly because of some of the issues that came up with one particular bipolar medication that I'm no longer taking. And then, so I wake up every day, I do my medication, typically have a plan for the day, which includes, you know, stretching if I can and working out. Some of that depends on the day and how much work I have to get done. For me, I try to utilize my OCD to organize my day. So because I want to write everything down, I want to have everything specifically lined out, I utilize that to kind of have a game plan for the next day or the next even week. And I try to, honestly, for each day, I make a goal. I tell my students to do the same thing when they're practicing, but it works if you compress your whole day into a goal. Say, okay, today I'm going to get
this
done. That's
great. I mean, I think you're also talking about a universal truth of living with intention. So you have an awareness of your neuro style, and then you're mapping out your day. So medications are a tool in the toolbox, but so is fitness. So is good nutrition. And then maybe even like if you've had like a big performance night one night, do you find that energetically as someone that's so empathic that maybe you might need a few days of downtime? Do you integrate that into your wellness plan?
I honestly really need to. The one piece that's missing is I don't get a lot of self-care. Part of that is from taking on too many projects all at once. And, you know, I've made that mistake in the past. I'm getting better at it. But I was working 7 days a week for about 7 years. And my wife got a new job, and that was her first request. She said, I want you to only work 6 days. And as of September this year, I will just be at 5 days. And that gives me the ability to kind of have a couple self-care days. Like for me, missing work, if I don't show up, there's two parts to it. One, I feel like I'm letting the child down because I think consistency is so important for the learning process and also for the relationship building process. So that drives me to get to work. And then the other part, of course, is, you know, we're all under financial pressure no matter what. It doesn't matter how much money one might have or how little somebody does. We all feel the same kind of fear when it comes to money or wanting something. For me, I don't necessarily want a lot of things, but I do want to make sure that I'm there and I can help out my family if they need it. A lot of times, you know, my wife, I want to make sure she's taken care of. So money is always going to be an issue for everyone. But I try not to make that the center of, you know, my goals, because I don't think that's necessarily the healthiest way for me to go. I did that in the past, and it's just not it's not fun for me. So like you said, I'd rather, yeah, map out, utilize my strengths that I have. And instead of looking at the day as, oh, each day I wake up and I am bipolar or I am OCD. Instead, it's like, hey, look, these things today, that's how they're going to help me. And it's a slightly different approach, but for me, it has worked. And each person, as you mentioned before, is going to have a different approach, something that worked for them. For me, I need some sunlight. I do much better with exercise. I do take fish oil, and you know, that's the main supplement I take. And then I also take turmeric. Those two I like, and then I eat healthy.
That's fantastic. So Kirk, to me, what you've described today is that you are on this journey of health and well-being, and that it's an optimal health and well-being that we're all striving for, but that's our own unique path. And so what I also like about the way you, when in your writing with Chaos to Cured, and then, you know, the show, we're going to talk just briefly here at the end about the show that you co-host, that you've been advocating for people to seek out their own best health, and that always Western, Eastern, that people need to champion what their own inner voice is telling them. And you'll be surprised at how much you can achieve your own personal best.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and actually what you just said is, I think, perfectly worded. Everyone has the potential. It's a hard journey. And, you know, I think that it's important for, I think, for empathy to work, it has to be on both sides. And I think a lot of times people struggling with mental health sometimes forget those in their life that aren't struggling with the same severity of a mental health issue. So for me, I think it's really important to remember the people out there that, like my dad, who's just completely stable. He's just rock solid. That is something I really admire. And, you know, I think it's important to make sure we respect each and every person. And of course, no matter who they are, what their opinions are, being open-minded, as you'd mentioned earlier, is so important, because there's not one person I have not learned something from. And that includes people that have hurt me emotionally or have hurt me whatever way it might be. If they've caused a negative impact in my life, that's still a learning process that I can utilize to make a positive difference in how I change myself and in how I move forward with life. So, you know, everyone's going to have a certain degree of their own issues. And if we realize that we're all, I'll use your hashtag, I love one humanity. We're all in it together. There's not one person that's more special than another. We all have this amazing ability to make the world a better place, and working together and being there for each other, empathizing and being compassionate, the more you do it, the honestly, for me, it's slightly, I hate to use the word addictive, but it's definitely something that gets easier to do for me each day. And it's something that I want to do more of the more I do it.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because it goes back to those core things that I discussed, universal truths for feeling well, awareness, self-love, and altruism. But one of the biggest things that you mentioned that I'm just thinking is that sometimes we can forget to put our own oxygen mask on first. I've done that. You've done that. And so the addicting part, it is incredible to help others. In fact, I spoke about that in one of my podcasts about when you're an empath, you feel other people's feelings so strongly. So it's like you want to help them. And then there's this reinforcement loop. So I think the key is balance. Because you use the word addiction, there's nothing wrong with like being addicted. Getting extreme joy out of helping others. But if you do that at the expense of your own self-care and you're not aware of that, then you're not necessarily in balance. It doesn't mean you're not going to have a day where you're off balance or we're all going to have days like that. There's nothing wrong. See, the linear language doesn't allow us the shades of gray. I mean, one of my colleagues said to me on Friday that I'm about to do some work with, she was so eloquent because she's had a super creative week. And she's like, I've been off balance, but she was off balance intuitively and aware. She knew she was doing filming. She knew she had to talk to people. She loved it. She got great joy, but then she's using the weekend as a respite to rest, to retreat. And so I think using our own internal GPS system of awareness allows us to have optimal mental health. And I think when you have the neuro style of mania or something, sometimes it's hard to know when to hit the brakes.
Did
you say?
One thing that I have noticed is a lot of people, just as they start really feeling good and they do find their stride, a lot of times the first thing they want to do is help other people. And the main thing that I suffered from at the beginning was a little bit of burnout. And I think a lot of people do. So what you said is, I just wanted to thank you for saying that. I think it's very important. But of course, if you take care of yourself, that enables you to help someone else, or it helps you to continue your journey. At least it's always going to be interrupted in some ways, but at least as pleasantly as possible.
So, Kirk, how can everyone find you, order your book, listen to your radio show?
Well, if you have a Kindle or a Kindle app, that's definitely the way I would go because it's much less expensive than the paperback book. If you want to have the paperback book, it's on a pretty tall book, so it's fairly thin. It's about 60,000 words or around 55, I think. But as far as the book itself, you can find it on Amazon.com. You can find it at BarnesandNoble.com. So if you have a Nook, you can do it there too. But I definitely highly suggest the electronic copy. You could save a couple dollars. But everything I get, all royalties from that book, all of them go directly towards a nonprofit that I set up, which is Healing Unique Minds. It's a 501c3 nonprofit account. And I use whatever I get from that, and I typically donate to International Bipolar Foundation was last year, or whatever good foundation is out there. All proceeds go to that. So you can find it there. You can find me on Twitter with the @chaos and then the number 2, @chaos2cured. And I do want to be very upfront. Cured, it really should say Chaos to Remission as the title of my book, because I'm not going to stop taking the medication. We don't know if it's a cure. What I do know is that whatever we did, I have not really suffered from a swing. I had in at least over, 9+ years. So, if there's a chance for people out there, I think everyone needs to make sure they stay on top of things, follow their doctor's advice, follow their own intuition, research carefully. There's a lot of misinformation. And anytime someone, says there's a a supplement or a miracle treatment for something, you know, please talk to your doctor. I think that's always important, and feel safe talking to your family, your friends, your doctors. And of course, at the same time, if you're not ready to share your story, that's one thing I tell people is never feel forced. It's okay to just listen to.
That is excellent advice. Can I call this, would you, with your permission, because I want to respect and honor the title of your book and who you are, but I'd like to call the title of this podcast that I'm going to launch, Chaos to Remission.
I think that's
okay.
It doesn't ring as well, which is one reason the publisher wanted the guest to carry it, but I think it's a much more appropriate statement, to be honest. I like
well,
that.
Well, what do you want me to do? I'll do either. I want to make sure I'm telling your story.
It's because it's always going to be there, and it's something that I'm proud to battle each day, and not necessarily battle, but I'm proud of what I have. And I think if we looked at, you know, genetically changing people and getting rid of bipolar completely or getting rid of some of these things, I think we would miss out on a lot of special aspects that these things bring. So it brings up a different issue.
You know, can we actually, that's a very important point, but I want to make sure I end it the show showcasing you. But that's another reason why I define the word neurostyle, that we all process and perceive information in our own unique way. I see some of the most gifted, talented artists having neurostyles that have flavors of mania, ADD, OCD. And so whether we need to just think and talk about these things in new ways. And we also need to not rule out Eastern thought, rule out Western thought. We need to come together and bridge all modalities of well-being. And Kirk, that is what you have done. So thank you for this inspiring interview. And I look forward to having you on the show or future collaborations.
It has been just an absolute delight. Have a beautiful day, and I'm happy to anytime.
Okay, thank you. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week.